Welcome to the Gospel Grammar Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Batzig, and I am the senior pastor of Church Creek Presbyterian in Charleston, South Carolina. I'm here with my co-host, D.B. Cummings, who is a ruling elder at Church Creek. D.B., it's always good to be on with you, buddy.
Yeah, no, I'm excited about this one. Really interested in this topic. I think it's pretty unique, and I can't wait to hear what our guest has to say.
Yeah, we do have a unique topic. It's a large issue for us in the local church, and we have invited my dear friend, Nate Sheridan, onto this show. Nate is the pastor of Cornerstone Presbyterian in Franklin, Tennessee. He has written for Ligonier Ministries. He wrote with me for the Christ Word Collective at the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. He serves as a faculty member, I believe, Nate, of New College Franklin. As you guys who are listening to us have already heard, we're having a number of the guys in our company of pastors on this show on the front end. And Nate is one of those guys, together with Fred Greco and Guy Richard and all the other men that we're having on this show from our company of pastors. So, Nate, great to have you on.
It's great to be with you, Nick and DB. Thank you for the privilege.
Yeah, we had Nate down to Church Creek to preach this last year, and it was great to have him here. And I have gleaned so much wisdom, Nate, from you over the last 13, 14 years of our time together, especially on the subject of developing a local church, how we structure it, the issue of staffing, how we build out those systems and structures that help the local church run smoothly beyond elders and deacons, which are obviously the main positions in a local church biblically. And Nate, we just wanted to invite you on to talk a little bit about church staffing and structuring. So thank you again for being on.
Well, it's an important subject, Nick, and one that requires a lot of wisdom, especially as one who is leading a church yourself. You know the different issues that we sometimes face trying to figure out how to serve Christ's church the best, and what does that mean in terms of staffing. And so I'm grateful you're taking time on the podcast to talk about this important subject.
Now, Nate, how long have you been at Cornerstone?
Well, we're coming up on our 15th year anniversary at Cornerstone. It was 2010 where I originally moved here to Franklin, Tennessee from Jackson, Mississippi, and then planted Cornerstone the following year in January of 2011. That was our very first worship service, was January the 16th of 2011. So hard to believe it's been nearly 15 years.
Well, I've got to make a little qualification here, Nate. Back in the day, I was planting that church outside of Savannah, Georgia, and it was a parachute church plant. And I asked you, how large was your core group when you planted out of Christ Community and Parish Pres there in Nashville? Yeah. And you said 300. I said, Nate, that's not a church plant. That's a fully developed, large size, small church.
Yeah, the Lord did give us a strong core group, and you might say a large, a mid-sized church almost growing out of it. We didn't wind up having quite that many in the plant when it actually started, but we had a large group of interest and a lot of support from our mother church, Parish Presbyterian Church, to help us get off the ground. And so the Lord's very kind in that regard to help us get established as a church. But yeah, that was true. The Lord gave us great support.
Well, Nate, I wanted to have you on because as I was planning the church outside Savannah, I was kind of tapping you constantly, trying to pick your brain about where you had developed and how you had developed ahead of us, and looking at what you were doing and thinking, you know, if we're going to get to where Cornerstone is, I want to learn what Nate has done in putting these structures and these systems in place and the staffing issue. So as we just enter in on this discussion and we talk about the development of a church, there's always need for more structure. That's something that all of our pastors who are listening to this will know. You always need more structure. I think about that book, The Trellis and the Vine, a lot. You know, the church organically is a vine, but you got to have the trellis for it to grow up. Many churches erect committees or ministry teams as they hit that 70 person or 100 or 120 or 140? Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about why developing structure in a growing church is so important?
Yeah, you know, church size really does matter in terms of what is needed to maintain and sustain health and growth in a local congregation. And having a church of 50 and having a church of 250 is a very different reality. And there does require more infrastructure, more design, more strategy, more tactic in terms of how to faithfully care, in Timothy Whitmer's words, for the macro and micro care of a local congregation. Mm-hmm. And just as parents would feel this when they have their first child and they're overwhelmed by it, but then have a second and a third and a fourth, should the Lord bless, they realize that they're going to have to grow and learn how to care for each of those children different. And that's going to require a varying level of structure and design and systems to be able to put in place. And so what may have worked faithfully when a congregation was 100 is likely not to work in the same way when a congregation is 400 or 500. And so one of the phrases we use here is thinking about how to scale for health and growth, being sure that we are taking care of the breadth of the congregation and the depth of the congregation as more sheep are brought in and as a larger ministry platform is conducted through our local congregation. So it seems to me a part of what the Westminster Confession of Faith would call the light of nature, or the wisdom and the recognition of not all things are the same, and we need to bring varying levels of mind to particular churches to see how best to be able to scale for that health and growth.
Yeah, one of the things that I learned pretty early on, taking a core group from maybe 50 people to 70 people to 100 people, even in that dynamic at 50 or 70, everybody feels like they're in the know. It's kind of easy to mobilize the whole group. If you have an outreach event, you can delegate pretty easily as the church planner. But then once you start hitting about 100 people, people feel like they're not in the know, things have changed, and maybe you start erecting committees or ministry teams that you get volunteers plugged into in order to get other members utilizing their gifts and serving. But then when you get to about 120, I think that tends to be the magic number, you really need to start staffing more purposefully and moving from volunteer committees to staffing. When we think about that issue of staffing, I know some Reformed pastors, some close friends that I love and respect, and they will say things to me like, Nick, the only positions a church ought to have are elders and deacons. And I respect that because biblically, yes, they're the only officers, they're the only leaders in a church, if you want to take that formally. Mm-hmm. But how would you answer that sort of objection to the idea of a church needing more than just elders and deacons, actually needing staff members, like an administrator, or down the road, a staff pastor, or a director of operations, or a youth director, or whatever it is? How would you respond to somebody that says all the church needs is elders and deacons?
I sympathize as well with those brothers, and I have friends who would echo a similar thing with regards to the church's structure and design as office bearers of elders and deacons are what has been given to the church. And one of the things that we would want to do in staffing would be to protect the office of elders and deacons and not replace or subvert or seek to in any way undermine what the Lord has laid out in the God-given structure of authority of elders and deacons in a body. I would go with that in a couple ways, though, when we're talking about staff, Nick, recognizing my sympathies with that sentiment. At the same time, one of the things I see staff actually doing is helping to free up elders and deacons to actually answer their God-given job descriptions that are outlined in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 and illustrate it as we see throughout the letters of Paul and the book of Acts. Because what often happens is elders and deacons can get mired into the nuts mm-hmm. and the bolts of just putting on the day-to-day work of ministries and programming and actually find with their day jobs and the demands of their life, not enough time to do the oversight and shepherding of a congregation, which really is mm-hmm. the bread and butter of what it is they're called to do. And so they early on may have been, you know, they may have been running the copies for the bulletins or laying out the bulletin or getting slides together or setting up chairs and praise God for all of those wonderful things. And yet many in the body of Christ can be doing those things. And that can be given away. I think this is a key verse, Ephesians chapter 4, verses 9 to 15, that tells us that we are to be about equipping the saints for the work of ministry. So releasing God's people into the work of ministry. And I think that staff, if staffed well, and if the church as it grows sees that demand, you mentioned 120 or whatever the magic number is, as it starts to staff well, the staff not only see themselves as helping taking care of some of the business that's happening in the body of Christ, but they're actually removing some of the things that were on the shoulders of the elders and the deacons mm-hmm. so that they might be freed up to do their work and then help the congregation to be further equipped for the work of ministry. And so they're serving almost as a supportive role to the office of elder and deacon, not in a replacing form. And it seems to me that that's a healthy way for staff to be, to understand their role in the body of Christ.
Yeah, and that's so well said. I mean, I think about our own officers. DB's here on the podcast with us. I have some incredible elders who are giving of themselves more than many elders I know personally. And I obviously am biased, but I have incredible elders. But they have full-time jobs, and they have children, and they have their own lives to manage. And it does seem to me that staff frees up those men to do the more important work that God has called them to, as you've noted. So I really appreciate that.
True. And I think principally, and this is something to reflect on, but when you look at Acts 6, for instance, why, you know, I take Acts 6 as kind of a proto-deacon role that's being formed or shaped there in the men that are being chosen. They're being chosen in order to free up the elders to be able to give their time to the word and the sacrament and the discipline of the church. And the same thing can happen with staff. I think they principally can take some of that off the shoulders and help elders and deacons move towards the congregation in a freer way. And in that sense, it's starting to work really as a healthy church.
Nate, so as we're thinking about staff positions and what really the next position that we need on our church staff, how can pastors or even sessions with their pastors best assess that need when they're trying to figure out what the next staff position should be?
That's a great question. And when you figure that out, DB, let me know. there are things I'm continuing to learn on that particular question, but I do think if you are, as elders and deacons, and this is a kind of a structural piece that I think is important, having regular macro evaluation of the health of the church and its ministries. And as you're evaluating those ministries, and it could be the teaching ministry of the church, it could be the discipleship ministry of the church, the missions ministry of the church, it's shepherding, whatever it is you're evaluating. And then as you're getting into how you conduct those ministries, it might be through women's ministry, youth, men's ministry, whatever it is you're doing. If you're reviewing those on a regular basis and you're evaluating it, what I think tends to happen then is you're going to see patterns that are going to develop in the life and the health of a congregation where you're going to say, hey, we keep stubbing our toe on X. Mm-hmm. We keep missing Y. Mm-hmm. And then the question becomes, is there something in a staff form or structure that would help us be able to get at that matter more deeply and achieve it more effectively? And so I do think faithful evaluation and review of the church at a macro level and at its ministries level helps a dialogue between pastors and elders develop so that you might have your eye on a position or the concept of a position and start crafting a job description or start thinking through what it might look like. And I think then you can start to scale those things out a bit. So that becomes a part of the strategy for staffing.
Nate, when we think about developing a staff and adding the right people, and there's a litany of questions that we're not going to touch on. How do we find the right person and, you know, fittedness? We'll come back to that toward the end of this interview. But are there boundaries that ministers ought to be thinking about? For instance, should churches be hiring husbands and wives? Should they be hiring officers' wives? This is a question that I think a lot of our brothers have when we're looking at what we have internally, what we could work with. But it does seem like there could be conflicts of interest and things that could harm the congregation if we're not wise. What are your thoughts on boundaries with hiring staff?
Oh, it's a very important subject to have and to address and for have elders to be clear on those matters as to how they think about them. There is a greater level of risk if you're bringing a husband and a wife together on your ministry team, a greater level of risk for conflict of interest, for potential conflict actually within the staff. And then just the potential for some abuse of some kind to take place or something to happen. And I think that having an honest dialogue and even creating, depending on the nature of the church, might be creating a policy where, hey, we don't even entertain that. That's not even a possibility on this church staff. And here are the reasons why. We have not made that particular statement on our particular staff, but we have some principles and guidelines through the interview process and review processes to ensure that those stay clean and accountable. So, for instance, if the best person for a position might be an elder's wife, as we've done interviews, it might be an elder's wife. We want to be sure if that's the case and all of our personnel committee is agreed on that, the recommendation comes to the session does its work, they're agreed on that. We want to be sure that that elder and that wife he's not in any way overseeing that position. Their ministry efforts are in no way overlapping. We're going to put an extra measure of review each year to talk about that relationship. So it's going to be a regular ongoing aspect, even with other staff. And with other elders, we're going to ask, hey, have you seen anything? Are you concerned about anything? Is anything clear? And everything in the clear, we'll let them know, hey, we think this is the best thing for the church. We think that this woman, this man in this role is what's right. And yet by doing that, we know we're bringing in a greater level of risk. And so here's the extra measure of steps we're going to take in order to ensure things go smoothly. Now there's no foolproof on any of those things. There's always the potential of issues, but one would need to do due diligence and have an honest conversation with elders and deacons on that to be sure whatever it is that you step out to do, that you understand the risks that are involved and where those boundaries might need to be put in place.
Yeah, that's so helpful. One more question on boundaries here. When we think about staffing, and I mean, this question could be answered a dozen different ways, but there might be positions that you wouldn't want a man to fill, and there might be positions that you wouldn't want a woman to fill. That's a little bit different than in the secular world. In the secular world, a job opening comes up. They're not going to say, we're only looking for a man, we're only looking for a woman. But it does seem to me in the church that there might be those occasions where those boundaries need to occur. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a good question, Nick. I think as one who is committed to a complementarian view of male and female relationships and acknowledging that men and women are created different and yet are meant to labor side by side and complementary both in the family but also in the context of the church. And I think the Lord lays out some clear parameters along those lines as we're looking in the scriptures. It's appropriate to say, even to think generally, as you're looking for a nursery coordinator or you're looking for a children's director, to say it would make sense for us to wait in some sense this position towards a female candidate, given the fact that there are maternal instincts mm-hmm. that we're looking for as a part of this particular job. That does not mean that a man can't operate in such a nurturing and caretaking way, but it is to say that generally speaking, this role has paired well with the maternal gifts that have been given in the supportive role in the context of the local church. And I think none of us who really understand the nature of male and female relationships biblically given bat an eye at that. We see mm-hmm. that as actually accentuating the way in which the Lord is actually designed. Also, there could be roles where a woman be put in a position where she might be exercising authority in a way that would not be appropriate with mm-hmm. regards to a man. Mm-hmm. That's especially true with one who may be ordained in ministry, a pastor or an elder in a context. We don't want to see, have a woman put in a position where she is exercising undue authority over a pastor or an elder, or maybe in a context of a staff where it would be more appropriate for the element of masculine headship to be expressed in this particular role. And we're looking for a particular kind of leadership or vision that's given in that role. And so I think honest dialogue for among the elders or whatever committee might be entrusted to this particular effort to say we want to focus our attentions with women in this case or men in this case because of what it is that we're looking for in this role. I think that's appropriate.
So helpful,
Nate. So talking about the office of deacon or elder, there might be an opportunity where there's a man in one of those who's an officer in the church who's also seems like the ideal match for a staff position. Should a church ever consider hiring a ruling elder or a deacon for a full-time staff position? And if so, how do you navigate the relationship that he's going to have to the other officers once he's in that position?
Hey, that's a great question and a perceptive one, DB, because well, I'll just say, first of all, we have a deacon that we have hired on our staff for a full-time position, and we went through this debate and discussion together when we did that. In fact, our church life coordinator, who helps organize logistically so many of our ministries, our calendars, helps facilitate, has a lot of executive functions kind of within our church staff, is actually an ordained deacon in our body. And so that was a big debate and question. And it was a question for him and it was a question for us. One thing is he did not want to lose the pleasure and the joy that he experiences working with the deacons in a volunteer role mm-hmm. in the context of the body in areas of hospitality and in areas of welcome and other things that he does in our body. And yet at the same time, he saw that his gifts matched up very well with mm-hmm. what it is we needed for the church life coordinator position. And so we said, what we're going to have here is a kind of Venn diagram. There's going to be some overlapping circle with regards to your liaisoning with the deacons. You're going to have a role of communication and connection and help organization with regards to our deacon, our diaconate. And yet there's going to be a whole part of your job description that's not going to be connected to your volunteer mm-hmm. role or operating as a deacon. And to say, what we'll do is every year we want to review that. And we know that when we review that, there's going to be areas where fine-tuning is going to mm-hmm. be needed. And that mm-hmm. has certainly been the case. If he was on this podcast, he'd be talking about that. There have been times where the deacons have said, hey, just give this to the church life coordinator. You know, mm-hmm. like he's our guy. And I told him, hey, we want to be giving it back to them, you know, and tell them why mm-hmm. this needs to come back to them. And to do that in a way where that's an open dialogue between mm-hmm. the staff deacon in this case and the diaconate and helping liaison that, we knew would create a little bit of complexity. But we felt the risk was worth the reward by mm-hmm. having this particular man in that role. And I think all on our diaconate would say that, and this man would say that. Mm-hmm. But there is, again, just as we said earlier, we are inviting a little bit more risk when we mm-hmm. do something like that. And but that has to be measured out to see whether that risk is worth taking. And I'd say I know some ruling elders who are full-time employees of local congregations. And mm-hmm. I would say in many of the cases I've seen, it's been one of the great blessings mm-hmm. to those local congregations. So
Yeah, I think of Mel Duncan there at Second Pres, and Mel is the prototypical Ruling Elders staff member. We just hired one of our deacons to be our director of operations, almost the same position as you've articulated, and it's been wonderful, but we've had to navigate some of that, Nate, so I find that to be really, really helpful, just thinking through the dynamics of that.
Yeah. I think that's right. And the fine tuning of that is the way that it's worked is there, you know, just recognizing that, you know, there's the job description that's written and then there's the reality of the role that's inhabited. And we knew we'd have to get a year into his role before we knew where the trouble spots were going to be between the diaconate and him and how to clarify those lines and for him to build, in his case, to actually build some confidence in being able to speak to the diaconate, to share that, to help kind of own that authority in that role that had been given to him, and for the diaconate to learn to check up on him, to make sure that they know they're not in any way abusing his role in some way, to abdicating their responsibilities. And I think if you've learned to do good communication, you've created the right channels, you've got checks and balances in view, you've got a process for when conflict arises, you can take some of those holy risks that actually might turn out to be the greatest blessings for the church.
That is so good. Nate, you know, I took a pastorate in a church that really never had staffing prior to me coming here, and the elders have supported my leadership in adding staff and developing as we have grown, and the Lord has brought us the needs with so many more people. One of the questions that I got probably about a year into the ministry as we started adding staff for the first time in the life of this church, an older man who's an emeritus elder asked this question at a vision banquet that we were having at the beginning of a year. He said, "What percentage of the church budget should reasonably be set aside for staffing?" It was a good question. That's one that I know our company of pastors have talked about at different times. I've always been under the impression that if you have a growing church of, you know, 150 plus, that it's reasonable to think 40 to 60% of the budget probably should go to staffing to carry the heavy weight of the work of ministry, to free the elders and deacons up, as you've already said. What are your thoughts on that, on percentage of the budget? I know there's no objective standard per se.
You know, we a few years ago did a lot of research on this particular question. And, you know, with our own denomination, we're a Presbyterian Church in America congregation. And we went outside and looked at our local community here in Franklin and Nashville, which has changed a lot in the last 10 years in terms of the economics of the place in which we live and the cultural moment in which we're in. And we realized that when we did that research, we were a bit behind just in terms of how we were thinking about finances and budgets and even staff. And but the number that you just threw out of 40 to 60%, 60 on the very high end, 40 on more the low end, is what we found to be normative within congregations that were roughly the same size as we were. And we were under 50 at that point. We're slightly over 50 as a congregation right now in terms of our annual budget. One of the things my elders very helpfully did is they did the research on that, and they hired actually a firm and helped them sort of think through some of those things, which was super helpful to be able to collect that information, because it's actually hard to get good data on it. It's hard to get more than anecdotal information from a local church or a presbytery. And another presbytery might not match up with your presbytery in terms, you know, Southern California is pretty different than, you know, Southeast Alabama or in terms of the economics and the cultural place in which they're in. And so we wanted to do that well in our area. And we found that centering around about 50% of the budget was a good target in terms of thinking of how much should go towards a local staff. And the church and the elders led the way really in this of recognizing that with the church, you know, you're not a business, the work, the investment's not, I mean, you'll have facilities, you'll have a building, but the investment's not the building. You'll have resources that you'll have to buy things and have to acquire things, but it's in the people. Mm-hmm. and it's in the staff and the pastors that you're hiring. These are the means through which the ordinary means of grace are made known through the body, through the ministry of the people. And so I do think prizing that with regards to staff and letting your money go where your mouth is in terms of what you've professed is an important thing for congregations to think through.
I do want to make a quick caveat. When we talk about staffing, and we've talked about church life coordinators or directors of operations, administrators, all these other what we might call administrative staff. But you just mentioned you also have staff pastors here in the PCA. We have assistant pastors and associate ministers, and they serve under the senior minister. So I do want our listeners to know when we're talking staff, we're including other ordained teaching elders who are under the senior minister, are an extension of his ministry to help free him up to do his job as well. So I think that's important just to note that.
That's good. No, that's very important.
So speaking of staff pastors, then, Nate, are there wisdom principles that you can share with our listeners about the way in which a church thinks about paying those staff pastors in relation to how they pay the senior pastor?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of factors that go into these questions on finances and on payment and remuneration for the work of ministry. I think you certainly want to look at the level of authority that you're asking an assistant minister to exercise within a local body. He's obviously going to operate under the leadership of the senior minister, and as Nick helpfully put, an extension of, in many ways, the ministry of that senior minister. But it could be that you're hiring an assistant minister or an associate minister, as the case may be, that's going to be an executive pastor, and he has been asked to oversee other staff, or there's a ministry area that has other staff under it, and he has to exercise authority with regards to those staff. He may be the first line of oversight as it comes to those staff. It seems that the whoever is making those decisions on recommendation for the assistant pastor's remuneration would want to look at the weight or the heft mm-hmm. of that job description. Is this a man who's exercising tasks and accomplishing areas of ministry, or is he overseeing, giving vision to, and is being entrusted with a greater measure of leadership? So I think those are one of the things that you want to look at with regards to how that works commiserately with his remuneration. I think his age and his stage is one of the things that you're going uh-huh. to weigh in value. Is he a new minister fresh out of the gate, newly minted in the work of ministry, and doesn't bring much experience to bear and is going to require a good bit of oversight with regards uh-huh. to the senior minister or the executive minister, whoever's overseeing him? There's going to be an element there. So age and stage is going to come in. So you're going to want to weigh and evaluate those things. And just as you would with your senior minister, looking over size of church, location, his longevity in ministry and pay accordingly, you're going to want to do that with assistant ministers to say, okay, what are other churches doing along those lines with those assistant ministers? And I think that we've always noticed, and I think this has been true, is erring on the side of generosity when it comes to these servants of the Lord, whom he brings into our midst. And when we've erred on that side, and I think more times than not, we've sought to do that, we have seen the Lord, and this is just, you know, again, just his kindness. We have seen the Lord add to the coffers at Cornerstone. We have seen him bring in God's people, givers to our congregation. I say often to the elders as we're looking at hiring staff or especially assistant ministers, and we've got some incredible gifts on our body here, is that good assistant ministers, good staff, they wind up, just from a practical standpoint, paying for themselves in their work of ministry because they create their own center of gravity. And as the Lord builds fruit within the ministry, there are folks that are blessed to be a part of your congregation and sit under their labors in ministry. So I think those are great things to keep in mind as you're looking at assistant pastors and senior ministers' pay and remuneration in the whole system. So,
thanks, Nate. That's helpful. And, you know, it can be tempting for a church looking to help one of its members who's struggling financially to hire them onto staff as a way to help them with their financial challenges. Maybe they're having a problem with employment or whatever it might be. Is that ever wise? Can that lead to potential problems?
Well, all of the above there to sort of think through. But I'll say this. If, you know, there's a beautiful thing when someone's need matches up to their gift and skill set and it connects to the body of Christ in a beautiful way. We've seen that happen in cases where there's been a loss of a job of someone who is in our body. And the matching up of what we needed at just the right time came. And so it served their needs, but it served our needs. But we went through, in any case that was the situation where that happened, we went through the same hiring process we would go through. We did the same work of interviewing multiple people and asking for applications. Even if we had this man or this woman in mind as showing God's providence, his providence is meaningful. They have a need. We have a need. Their gifts match up. We're going to go through the process here and consider. And so we've seen that happen. On the other side, I would just say, and this is something, you know, to hiring a position is not the ministry of benevolence. So when we're hiring a staff member, we're not doing it as an act of charity. And I think that would be to outweigh the wrong things. That would be to weigh the needs of this individual over and against the actual needs of the whole body, because this person's going to be serving within the whole body. Those have got to match well if this is going to work out. And so you don't want to do it. It's not a benevolence case when we're hiring a staff position. And so that can cause a lot of problems. I mean, as you might imagine, you'll match up with a position that actually is not a good match. You'll wind up sacrificing what you really need in this role because you're trying to help and care for this individual. And down the line, it'll cause you more heartache than help if you let the need of the person actually drive your staffing decisions. And so I would certainly caution against making such a decision in that case.
That's so helpful, Nate. Moving on just briefly to the management of staff. We've kind of touched on that in roundabout ways, but in a more focused way. When we think about a nursery coordinator, a children's ministry coordinator, a youth minister, an assistant pastor, a director of operations, an administrator, whatever those positions may be, should the staff primarily be reporting to the senior pastor? We'll come to the executive personnel committee thing in a moment, but just on a day in and day out basis, is that something you would advise? Are there nuances you would raise to that?
Yeah, I would say one of the things you want to consider is the size and structure of the church. If you're a small congregation and you have a fairly small staff scale, so let's say you have 4 to 6 members on your staff, in a case such as that, it's often, if the senior minister is able, depending on what's being asked of him from the session, what's the nature of his job description, his time, capacities, all of those things, it would be ideal in a situation like that where the minister himself is overseeing, I think, most of those staff. He's the one who's able to actually see their job performance day in and day out. He's the one who can have the best read on how to do that. So him being at least what I would call the first line of oversight in a context like that seems to make good sense. As a congregation grows, that's going to become untenable. So let's say you have 12 staff and you still, you know, the minister is preaching and teaching and shepherding and doing lots of things for the care of the body, doing pastoral care. The staff oversight is going to require a lot of him and going through review processes and all of those things with those staff is going to be a headache and actually might pull him away from what's most central to his calling in many cases. When that's the case, you're going to need other staff persons, elders, deacons, as the case may be, to serve as that first line of oversight. And the way you can help, you can tier that structure. So where, you know, like in our case, our youth minister has two youth interns that work under him. So we'll just use that as an as a case in point. He is the first line of review for those two youth interns. And then I meet with him in his review of his two youth interns. And so I'm not doing them all, but he's conducting it. I receive all the paperwork, their response, his response. So I know what's gone down. And then everybody has the opportunity to speak to a third party if there are any conflicts or issues that need further elucidation or elaboration that, that may have come out. So if there's a complaint against, let's say, the youth director at this point from one of the interns, then that's going to be picked up by the personnel committee or the elders, and they'll meet with that individual at that point. I think when you've created a, creating the clear lines of authority and structure is the really the greater key in it all, so that everybody knows what to expect. But I don't think it's tenable for the senior minister as it gets, the staff gets larger, for him to be the main line of contact for all of the staff.
Yeah. So a management scalability type thing.
Yeah.
Where you have sub-managers in these roles. Yeah.
It seems unescapable that you're going to need something like that if you want it to be healthy.
A number of years ago, Nate, we were talking and I was picking your brain about what you would do to build out something like what we're talking about. And you talked to me about your personnel committee. You've mentioned that already just in passing. Yeah. We recently took that cue from you. We created an executive personnel committee last year, two elders, one deacon, and a woman in the church, all of whom have managerial experience, run businesses, are they're very competent in managing staff, hiring and releasing staff members. And that has been a game changer for us. We're still developing it right now, but it has really paid off. Can you talk a little to our listeners about the role that your personnel executive committee plays with regard to the staff at Cornerstone?
Yes, that's good to hear, Nick. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm grateful you're finding benefit from that executive committee to do that work. Part of it is just an exercise of biblical common sense that with the abundance of counselors, there is wisdom. Having some of your members or of your leadership team who have experience in this arena to be able to be your chief executive counsels or conversation partners around matters related to staff really helps the minister be able to lead and guide in the best way possible. And so if I'm thinking about a staff member or if I'm having a matter that I need wisdom and insight on, they're the first people I go to. I don't bring it to the whole of the session. It rises to the sessional level if we have a real issue or real conflict that can't be settled at the other level. But they become the people who help me think about how to scale for health and growth. I run drafts of job descriptions by them. I let them red ink things and help me think through if we, you know, we're working right now on the potential of a combined nursery and children's coordinator job description. Don't know if that's a good thing to do yet. Should that be two people? Should it be one at the size we're at? I'm not sure. So I've written it and I've put it before them and that we're wrestling with it. And they're that we're helping think through the pros and cons of that particular piece. So it helps the minister to not be alone in those decisions. And a lot of us, to be honest, don't have, that's not our strength to think through those things. That's not even what we got into ministry for. And no one should trust us by ourselves making those decisions. Like, we need the help of others. And so that, I think, is really helpful. And then also in the review process, when they see we have a self-assessment that our staff does that you know, 9 or 10 questions that they're going to fill out. I'm going to be able to reflect on those that I review, or their supervisor is going to review. Those then go to our personnel committee. They can ask about those. They become the third party that kind of helps negotiate if there are issues and help us think through, you know, remuneration. They're the ones that help me do research on those matters earlier. And so it is, I think, you know, there's wisdom in the abundance of counselors. And so bringing those folks to the table seems like a great use of the gifts in the body of Christ to help us become who we're supposed to be. And so that's how I've used that committee, and that committee has gone, has changed and morphed over the years. We've adjusted the job descriptions on it and the charter for it to just continue to hone our mission, but it has been a godsend for us.
Yeah, I have found, just piggybacking on this very briefly, I have found that it also provides a buffer for the senior minister, because the staff members know that they are accountable to others other than just the senior minister, because things could go sideways very quickly, and that could turn very ugly. But if they have a structure in which they have to, an HR type, you know, department that they are responsible to work with or who are helping oversee, that just seems like it protects the senior minister a little bit too.
I absolutely agree. I think it does. And I think that I'm glad you put the buffer piece in there, at because you can actually put the shoe on the other foot as well, because the way I've structured it here, not only is that helpful for the senior minister. So if we're releasing someone, let's say we have a very difficult situation and there's a firing that has to happen, that's not Nate firing an individual, right? It's gonna go through the channels, and it will be a decision of the executive committee alongside the work of our session. And so as that happens, it's part of the work of a whole. And I think that helps me. Let's say if Nate just gets mad at somebody for something, I can't just go make a dumb decision and go fire. So it you know, makes the process slow everybody down, get emotions out of it, look at what's objectively true, work through the process, and if still a release needs to happen, then a release can happen. On the other side, ministers are sinners too, and we've seen many cases where there have been abusive relationships of pastors towards members, but we can see that towards staff. Mm-hmm. If I am acting unbecoming in some way or out of character towards another staff member of which I oversee, that staff member needs to have recourse with the committee to have me addressed in some way, so that can be brought to the fore. So not only does it protect the minister, it also protects the other staff from a minister who might be acting in sinful and unrepentant ways and that need to be addressed. So I think it works both ways.
Mm-hmm. So Nate, we're talking about, we've kind of led us to the area of like difficult relationships with the staff when things are not, it's a fallen world. So at some point, no matter how much we try to do these things well, we're going to run into challenges. So if a session comes to a point where they really feel like a staff member is not performing well in their role, but maybe could perform better in a different role, do you have any guiding principles or wisdom on what the session should do in that situation? And also, how does the session sort of navigate what might be a disruption to the congregation when staffing changes take place as well?
Mm. You know, sometimes it is the case that you've hired someone, they've worked in a particular role for a while, but their performance has been, underwhelming, we might say, with regards to the effectiveness of it and what's been produced. You want a trail of that. You don't, you know, that's where I think the informal and then formal review process is important. Mm-hmm. And try to give them the training and the support that you can give them to grow into that job. Because sometimes it's just a lack of training or a need for greater accountability, or you're learning that they need more. And so you want to explore those avenues first. You don't want to jump to the conclusion that they're just not cut out. And maybe we move them over here. I think if there is another position, if you see for a couple of years that these are gifts that could be better deployed here and they're not being deployed well here, there you need to have that conversation with the staff member and begin to float that by them. Mm-hmm. Get their feedback. Are they in agreement with you or not? If not, build the case for why they should be in agreement with you and help other people come alongside as to why that's the case, to be sure. And to say, the reason we're highlighting this is we see you more effective over here. Mm-hmm. Like when this situation comes up, you do great on these things. You know, you're amazing at, you know, here's the administrative, the office manager, you're great at meeting people. You're a great first face for us, a handshake on the phone. You're marvelous in these ways. You help do hospitality for the staff. You make sure all these things are done, but we can't get you to return emails in a professional way. Right. And we really need that in this. And actually that's pretty critical. And you do that. Have you thought about hospitality as a greater mm-hmm. role than maybe office manager? Has mm-hmm. that ever, you know, it's like, well, now that you mention it, you know, more times than not, people are going to gravitate to the parts of their job description they feel most inclined or most joy-giving to do. And if you can accentuate that and highlight it through their review, you can build a case for that transition, and it can go pretty smoothly in doing so. And we sometimes change positions, or we've moved things from one job description to another person, or these things to another person, in order to, again, try to best utilize the gifts that the Lord's given to that staff person. And just be honest about that. When it's most difficult is when they don't agree with you, or they are they're convinced differently. And the fact of the matter is, we sometimes do not assess our gifts very well. We all think we have a great. We all think we should win American Idol when we're singing in the shower. And so, the reality is sometimes going through a process to kind of help them best find their spot is the most loving thing to do before you get to the hard place where you say, you know, we have to agree to disagree on this matter, but for the life and the health of the church, we're going to need more out of this role than you've been able to provide. And because of that, we're going to need to be preparing to go another direction, right? And you're charting the course for a transition at the right time for that role. And, you know, you hope to not have to get to that place, but sometimes you do. And that's the work of leadership.
You know, I asked one of our spiritual fathers, Nate, Harry Reeder, about eight years ago, Harry, how do you deal with a staff member who is not filling the role that they've been hired to fill? They're a square peg in a round hole. Yeah. What do you do? And Harry got a little napkin out, as Harry would often do, and he put four little boxes on that napkin, and he said, I like to sit that person down and show them the four boxes, and in one of them, there's a circle that's really small inside that box, and one of them, there's a circle that's around the box, and one of them is half in and half out of that box, and one is a circle that fits perfectly. And Harry would say, now, you know, the small circle is you're not big enough for the job. And the big circle outside is you're too big for the job. And the circle that's half in and that's half good. Out is you're kind of half in, half out. And then the circle that fits is you're a perfect fit. And Harry says, every time I asked a staff person, where do you see yourself? No one would ever say they were too small for the job. They would always say, I guess I'm half in, half out. And Harry would say, then how do we get you to the box where this fits? And I thought that was really helpful.
That's a great illustration. And that better said, because it's coming from Harry, but that's exactly the spirit of what I think is the work of leadership, of oversight in those cases, is we want to see, as we would, and we use the language of alignment, we want to see you align best to this role and put you in the place where you will flourish, so that 70, we in our review process, we say 70% of the time and the energy of what you're spending in your role needs to go towards the things that are centered to your calling and gifts. There's always going to be parts of your job that don't well align. There's always going to be some stresses or strains, things you got to stretch to be able to do. But if that becomes more dominant in your role, and then your stress and anxiety are going to increase, and your sense of fulfillment in the role is going to decrease, and our sense of experiencing your effectiveness is going to decrease simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And so we're genuinely trying to get you to where you can best be used in the body. And so Harry's illustration is an excellent one to communicate those realities.
Nate, how can a senior pastor best lead his staff spiritually to create a kingdom-minded environment as well as doing enjoyable things together?
Oh, that's good, man. That's really, in some ways, is the most important thing that the senior minister should be doing, is setting the spiritual climate of his staff and of his elders, of his deacons, setting the tone for what the ministry is going to be all about. He has to first, that actually starts not with the staff, that starts in his prayer closet, and that starts with his time with the Lord, him not sacrificing his devotion and intimacy with the Lord and his prayers for his staff. I have a list of the favorite Bible verses of each of my staff members, for instance. I've asked them, you know, what's their go-to verses? They've given them to me, and I pray those verses over them and for them, and kind of make journal articles on how to continue to keep them before me. So we've got to be committed to their spiritual good. And that's got to start in our own commitment to be close to the Lord, and to be speaking to the Lord about them in prayer. And then we've got to spend time with them. We've got to spend time with them, and we've got to spend time with them, not just to try to get something out of them. People know when you're working in relationship to them because you're looking for a product. Or they know that you are spending time with them because you love them and you enjoy being with them, and there's no one else you'd rather be with. And part of what we say here on the staff of Cornerstone is ministry is hard. It's best to do it with friends. It's best to do it with people you'd want to be in the trenches with anyway. And so finding times to do enjoyable things, and that might be, you know, taking retreats. That might be, finding time to eat good meals together. Go do a fun event, or a concert, a sporting event. Go do something that's going to draw you together, just so you can spend time together, laugh together, tell jokes, poke at each other, and letting the senior minister setting that climate. And helping the staff feel at ease, both with him and with one another. And so I think once you've set, if you're setting that kind of relational climate, then you've built a level of trust. I can come to him, he can come to us, and he can share what's on his heart. And so at that point, we want to be praying together on a regular basis, doing kingdom-minded prayers, setting goals for what we want to see the happen in the life of our congregation as we're entering into the next season, and then praying towards those goals together, then rehearsing those goals. What did you see the Lord do? We have a discipleship ministry executive team here that reviews our ministries. And when we do those, one of the first things we say is, where have you seen the Lord at work in your area of ministry? Let's talk about where we're seeing him at work before we get down into anything else. And learning to share those stories and testimonies together. And then I think you've got to read together. You've got to do training together. You've got to equip the staff. If you're noticing, hey, we need to know each other better, or hey, we're not good at doing this with regards to ministry, let's read towards that. Let's discuss that. Let's strategize together. And when you're pouring into them and investing in them, that's going to be poured out into the congregation. You're going to start seeing those concentric circles riffle out. And so I think if you can start with yourself, your time with the Lord, caring for the staff, spend time with them, pray in a kingdom-minded way, look at the ministry, and then read and equip and train. If you're doing those things in the staff, and I think you're going to see great dividends towards that end. And I don't know, in saying all of that, if that feels overwhelming for a senior minister who's hearing that. But here's, I think, something to keep in mind, that I'm not saying that you have to do all those things, because you might not be able to do all those things well, especially some of the training and equipping. Now, the spiritual elements, you should be able to do that, that you should come equipped with that. But the training and equipping, you may not know how to get at that. Bring in somebody to do that. Bring in somebody who you think can help. Go find the help that your staff needs. You don't have to be the answer for everything the staff needs, but you should go find to be sure that that answer is found and help the staff. And I think actually that's a great exercise of leadership. If you can show them, hey, guys, I don't know actually how to get at this. I'm going to go ask some people, research. I'm going to come back to you, and we're going to together try to accomplish this task. I think that can be a great blessing to the staff to see you lead in that way. So that hopefully that takes some of the weight to be everything for your staff all the time.
Nate, thank you for sharing that with our listeners. I wish I had another hour with you, and we'll have you back on the show. This has been so incredibly helpful. I hope it's been helpful to our listeners. We brought Nate on because I really respect him as a leader, as a pastor, but as one who is leading very, very exceptionally in the church. But Nate is a preacher, and he is a teacher, and Nate is a very fine preacher. We want to encourage our listeners to visit cornerstonepresfranklin.org. Listen to some of Nate's sermons. If you have family or friends in the greater Nashville area, we encourage you to send them to Cornerstone PCA there, downtown Franklin. They have a beautiful building right at the crossroads downtown in that great area of Nashville. Nate, thank you for being on. Thank you so much.
Well, Nick and DB, it's been a joy. Thank you for having me.
And we are so thankful that you would take time to listen to another episode of the Gospel Grammar Podcast. We hope that you'll tune in again.